You're listening to episode 3 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi, I'm Klaatu, and this is the GNU World Order, a little podcast that I do from time to time. And in this episode, we're going to talk about me and my ongoing love affair with Linux. Today I'm going to explain, at last, some of the reasons that I just can't tear myself away from Linux. I truly love this operating system that I use, and you're about to find out why. Unix philosophy in general notwithstanding. That I've already discussed, so if you want the philosophical and pseudo-philosophical slash technical reasons that I like GNU and Unix stuff, and yes, I realize those two are technically somewhat mutually exclusive, but if you want that, then go back. I don't remember the episode, but I think it was maybe season 5 or 4, and I talked about the Unix philosophy and stuff like that. So, aside from that, this will be why I like Linux a lot. So, stay tuned for that exciting news. And I'll also be talking about Fedora and Debian, interestingly. Two seemingly incompatible topics. I'll actually be talking about them both with equal amounts of admiration and affection. So, let's get started. Okay, so first story first, I guess. I say that I don't usually cover news and things like that, but I keep covering this topic every time it occurs, so I might as well stay with that trend. Fedora has released their latest release. I still am kind of of the opinion that a 6-month release cycle seems pretty breakneck to me. Not really sure that I understand that. I still don't think that new artwork for every new release seems like a very good idea. I mean, I guess as long as they can pump it out, it doesn't really matter, but I don't know. It just seems like a lot of work to me for 6-month releases. I'm not clear on why that's necessary, but I guess I'm just all in all not that much of an upgrade fiend. You know, I don't feel the need to upgrade often, and so I can't really get into that sense of, oh boy, a new release. However, I got a MacBook Pro from this new job that I got, which is a pretty interesting job, and it'll probably start popping up in later episodes as I do more at this job and learn more and stuff like that. But for now, I got a new MacBook Pro, a MacBook Pro from this job, and of course I'm not going to run OS X on it. So I tried, I think it was Slackware, and there was some kind of weird boot issue that I couldn't afford the time to hack around that. I think I know what was going on. Something about the way that I formatted it to not preserve the fake FAT partition that we need to fool EFI into thinking that it's allowed to booting into it or something like that. So there's something going on with that. I wasn't able to spend the time on getting around that. So I thought, well, this is a work computer. I might as well just go ahead and put Fedora on here because the whole network that I'm going to be interacting with very soon is going to be running Red Hat anyway. So I'll just keep it all in the same family. So I installed Fedora 14 on this MacBook Pro, and I have to say that it installed brilliantly. It was the KDE Live CD version of Fedora, so it installs very quickly, and it works beautifully. It really does. The Broadcom chip inside of the MacBook Pro was not handled very well. It's the 4328, I believe. Linux Wireless, I think, says that it's supported, but I think you might have to go get the Broadcom firmware or something like that. I'm not 100% sure. Again, I haven't really had time to look into it because I've been doing other things at this job, so that's kind of low on the old priority list right now. But I will presumably keep you up to date as I get more on that. So yeah, there's that, and Fedora is quite nice. The cool thing about Fedora that I really wanted to say was we all know that it is cutting edge. That's kind of their thing, right? They get the newest features in first, and that's really cool and very scary, and that's why I like it. And yet, looking back at my experience with Fedora so far, it's all their cutting edge releases feel cutting edge, in the good sense, and they never feel cutting edge in the really bad sense. Now, there are exceptions, you know, I mean, I remember very early in Fedora 8, possibly maybe the end of 7 or something, you know, there were a lot of sort of weird SE Linux issues, and I remember there being Pulse issues eventually once they introduced that. So, I mean, there are things that I can't say, oh, it's always been perfect without any glitch at all. But overall, my impression and my experience and my feeling when I install Fedora, it's never that of dread, like, oh, is anything going to work at all? It all works really well. And more importantly, I think, is it's stable. It feels stable, even though it's not, you wouldn't really think of it as a stable release because it's cutting edge. It can't be stable and cutting edge, right? Well, it must be on the stable side of that cutting edge. You know, if there's the cutting edge and the bleeding edge, I really think that Fedora must somehow kind of figure out the safer portion of that and put that into the distribution. Or maybe it's just luck. I'm not really sure. I kind of doubt it that it's just luck. My point is, it's a really great distribution to get the latest features but still feel that sense of security that things aren't going to completely break down on you. And that's really cool because it's not always true on the more cutting edge, or I guess we could go ahead and say bleeding edge distributions. If you want the latest features, if you want some pretty artwork, and if you want a great little package manager that we call Yum, then try out Fedora. It's actually quite nice. And in a lot of ways, it still feels very properly Unix-y to me. I'm not sure why, and that's probably fairly useless opinion, since I can't even explain why. But I guess I have an issue with when I'm reading documentation from a project, and they're telling you what to expect after you install this product. And so then you go into /etc/foo to look for bar.conf, and wouldn't you know it's not there. And then you discover that the package maintainer has rather placed it instead of in the project's default /etc/foo, they've put it in /etc/config/foo/bar.conf or something like that, if you can just kind of go with me on that one. That kind of annoys me because I always feel like the project people, well, they know what they're doing, presumably, because they're programming the thing and they're writing it in their documentation, and to change it, to me, it kind of annoys me. Having said that, I don't maintain a distribution, so maybe there are some good reasons for doing that. Maybe it is nice to put everything into some consolidated folder in spite of the project's default locations. So it's not a deal breaker when distributions do that, but I've seen that occur sometimes, and it always confuses me. And that's, I guess, what kind of irritates me, I guess. But Fedora and in my limited experience with, well, I can't really say limited anymore, because, I mean, if we say that CentOS is the same as Red Hat. So in my experience with CentOS and Red Hat, it's been that way. They've really kept a lot of they've kept it very kind of like, I know where to find things, I know where things are going to be placed when I install them, and that sort of thing. Very unscientific. I there could be a million exceptions that I'm just not aware of because those aren't the programs that I use, but that's how it comes across to me. So that's why I like Fedora, and you should try it if you're curious. Okay, so that was the Fedora segment, now the Debian segment. And I've talked about Debian before, and I've said many, many nice things about it, and it's generally very theoretical and kind of, yes, I know Debian, and I've run it a few times, and yes, I admire it a lot. Well, for the past year, at my part-time job that I used to have until very recently, I was running on the workstation on the computer that my boss had given me. It was a Lenovo workstation, quite nice specs, and it was running Ubuntu. It's funny because I was always SSH'd into a CentOS box or a Solaris box, so in that sense, I was barely ever really using Ubuntu, but it was still right there. It was in front of me. I did some customization, got Flux up and running, stuff like that. So in that sense, I was running a Debian-esque environment. And now that I'm at this new job, I discovered a whole bunch of PowerPC computers that were just stacked up in this storage closet, not being used at all. So I pulled literally about 4 or 5 of them out of this closet and put 2 of them in my office, and then two of them in the server room. Yeah, so it was four, and then two G4s, actually, so that was six. But my point is that I pulled these PowerPC boxes and decided I was going to put them to good use, because I felt it was really a waste for them to just be sitting there in a storage closet. So I kind of assessed what my PowerPC options were these days on Linux, and I have to say that it's not looking quite as rich as I guess I felt it used to be. There used to be Fedora, which was one of my primary choices. Lately, that was my choice first and foremost. Before that was Slackintosh, but they seem to have kind of stopped development around 12.1 or 12.2-ish, so that doesn't really work out. Crux and Arch sort of have, well, they do. They have PowerPC versions, and then Debian, of course. So I tried all, oh, and Yellow Dog. So I tried all of these things, and for one reason or another, they didn't really work. And a lot of it had to do, I think, with some peculiarities of the G5 architecture and things like that, and literally some kernel issue, not kernel issues, but compiling a kernel against this G5. Fedora really had been my first choice, but I mean, they dropped PowerPC support, so that was out of the game. So for whatever reason, I kind of narrowed the really the best choice down to being Debian again. And it's funny because Debian used to be my de facto choice for PowerPC before I really tried Fedora, and I loved it. I really did. And now it's back. It's back on my PowerPC boxen. And I have to say that it's running really, really well. I'm still not sold on this whole package manager idea. Not necessarily in love with that. But to be honest, at work, I think the workflow is different, you know, because you've got other things you want to do at work. You want to poke around on the network or configure a router or pull some cables and see what happens. You know, you want to do fun stuff. At least I do at a networking kind of job. Yeah, at home it's fun to sit there and compile and custom compile all your multimedia applications. But I don't think at work I would relish that quite as much, because there are so many more toys to play with. You know, you've got hundreds of computers at your disposal. This new job that I've got is related to the network, so I've got quite a lot of resources available to me. So I am finding that the ability to just type in apt-get install, whatever, and just have it run, it is kind of nice. So I'm running Debian testing on all of these, well, on most of these boxes. One of them is a dual processor G5, and it's running Debian testing. That's my main workstation, and I installed KDE as my environment for that, because I needed something a little bit office-y-oriented, so I wanted to try KDE and really start using Kontakt a little bit more than just for mail. So, doing that, I've got a little server set up in my office, just a personal server that's a single CPU. I got another one set up in my office that will eventually probably be a server to share with some people. That's a single CPU. And then I've got two more in the server room and a dual G4 box that's going to be the internal Bugzilla machine and just random things like that. So Debian's just performing great. Some of them are doing testing. Some of them are, I feel fine just leaving it on stable, because it's going to be internal kinds of stuff that doesn't really need really anything special. It'll probably never get touched in terms of upgrading it for quite some time. I mean, no major upgrades. It's got like security stuff coming in and things like that, but that's about it. So that's really running well. And I have to say that I really appreciate Debian for this, because of all the distributions that I did look at, I really did feel really comfortable installing Debian on these boxes, because I felt like I could tell that they were being serious about it. I mean, you look at what they're supporting, and they're doing Spark, they're doing MIPS, they're doing ARM, they're doing PowerPC, x86, AMD 64, I guess that's probably it, but probably not, you know, IA, whatever. They're just doing everything. They've got Debian for everything. It's really, really cool. The installer is beautiful. The Debian installer never fails for me. I mean, or if it does, then the computer is probably just not going to ever work on anything. It's just phenomenal. It installs and fixes everything. It just makes sure that when you reboot that computer, you're going to get a Yaboot screen or whatever you're expecting, and you can get into your desktop or your computer. So it's really, really been a pleasant experience. And I have to confess that it wasn't my first choice at all. I really tried to avoid, and I mean that in the best of ways, avoid going Debian. I just didn't think it was what I wanted. You know, I didn't want the whole package manager thing. So I tried out all these other distributions, but in the end, it really, for what I'm doing, Debian was like the right choice. And I have to say, I really am enjoying it. I admire these people yet again for developing this free operating system and making sure that you've got the packages in the repository that you need. I almost feel like people who are getting annoyed at Debian for not releasing on time or soon enough or often enough or whatever, I honestly think I disagree with that sentiment. I'm going to say that Debian is doing what they're doing exactly correct. I'm not saying it's for me all the time. I'm not saying it's for everyone all the time. But I'm saying that at least for me right now, for what I'm doing with it, it is working perfectly. It's exactly what I needed, and I'm really happy that it's there. This is exactly what I needed. So really, really happy about Debian right now. Loving it a lot. And so that's that. That's Debian for you. Okay, so let's talk a little bit briefly about some of the newest features in Apple OS X's upcoming release, meaning next year's release. Their OS, I don't know if it's going to be 10.7 or 11, I really kind of forget, but it's going to have some features in it. And if you look at this, if you go to apple.com/OS X, and then I think it brings you to an error page, and then you can find the real link to Mac OS X. Then it offers on the bottom right corner, I think, a preview of all their upcoming features, a sneak peek. And I saw this, and I have to say that I was amazed, and here's why. There were these features that they're advertising that are taking cues from GNU Linux. And this is really, really interesting. And I did not feel offended or outraged or angry or anything like that. I actually thought right away how cool this was. Now, I realize that Apple has done this before. I mean, I'm sure other operating systems have too, right? Windows 7, I mean, come on, they ripped off KDE, you know? I mean, it looks exactly like KDE with the functions of that taskbar and little thumbnails and the overall look of it. It was just basically KDE ripped off visually. So, I mean, it happens all the time. It's not that big of a deal. But this one actually, I think, is a little bit unique because it's not just an idea or a convention that they rip off. It's not like, you know, when they came out with Spaces, which is what they call their virtual desktops on Mac. That was pretty simple and cheap, kind of, we'll just borrow that idea and not give you credit, thanks. That actually offends me quite a bit. And here's actually why. I might as well mention right now that, you know, when a Linux developer comes up with some new thing that borrows ideas from OS X, it is often stated in documentation or online stuff. It says, this little application gives you a doc at the bottom of your screen, like on OS X, something like that, where they kind of give you context by referencing the most obvious sort of place that convention might have come from, even though we could argue that a more apt description of it would be like the shelf in Java Looking Glass project. Apple, on the other hand, in their documentation, in their advertisement, in their keynote speeches, whatever, they never say that, right? They don't say, and look, now we're introducing a 3D spaced, a shelf that looks like it has 3D space, exactly like in Java's 3D Looking Glass project. They don't say that. They don't say, look, we have Spaces now, which is a lot like virtual desktops on a Linux box. Even if that would be meaningless to half the people listening, or 80% of the people listening, at least you've said it. At least you've given credit where credit was due. And for some reason, Linux developers do that, whereas Apple doesn't seem to do that at all. And technically speaking, they're doing the same thing here, because one of the big features on their new upcoming release, well, aside from the App Store, which is a lot like Linux repositories, but I guess that dates back to the iPhone at this point, so that was already done. No, the big feature that I was noticing was the netbook interface that they're developing. And I'm not kidding about this. This is actually serious. They're doing a netbook interface such that it has all the big application icons right there on the desktop in a row. And I believe from what the screenshots were looking, it looked like they were grouped into logical types of applications or something like that. I don't know. Honestly, I didn't really look that long. And while I was looking, I was just really, really excited. And here's why. It's because they're not just ripping off or emulating a look that Linux has, or even an application that Linux has, but they are answering the same question in the same way that Linux has answered. And by that I mean someone out there, and I have no idea who, someone out there identified or created, maybe, the need of saying, we have these tiny little computers, we need a specialized UI for this platform. And so they developed it. I hate it. I never did like it. I still don't like it. Some people, however, do like it. So the question was, can we develop a UI for netbooks? And the answer has been things like Mego, KDE Plasma Netbook desktop style, the Ubuntu Netbook Remix, things like that, right? Those are the answers to this question of how can we deal with this smaller screen real estate? How can we make it easier for people to find applications that exist on their system and so on? And Apple, now that they've actually got a netbook, 3 years after, 3 years late into the game maybe, now that they've got one to sell, it's fairly obvious that they are coming up with the same question, and they're coming up with the same answer. And I'm not saying it's not influenced by GNU Linux. In fact, I'm saying it is influenced by GNU Linux. The big deal, the thing that is getting me really excited, and that I think the whole GNU Linux community should really kind of, I don't know, be proud about, is that GNU Linux led the way. They pioneered something in UI design well before Apple, and we're not saying, okay, we're going to do this like on OS X. It's OS X saying we're going to do this, like those other guys did, even though they're not saying that, of course. But that's a big deal, I think. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever really accused GNU Linux of being progressive in UI design. And yet here they have, absolutely, they were, I guess, like Chad Wallenberg said, first to market. I mean, Chad didn't say that about what I'm talking about, but he said the term first to market. I'd never heard that before. So GNU Linux was first to market, which I think is a really, really big and exciting deal. And whether or not Apple bothers giving any kind of acknowledgement, and I can almost guarantee that they won't, we should all know that. We should recognize that. And we should be proud of that, because that's really, really cool. This is GNU Linux leading the way by example, and that's amazing. It's cool, and I hope that we can continue to do that in all different areas. So that's my love for Apple this episode. Speaking of loving things, let's have some coffee. Yes, go make yourself a great cup of coffee, maybe cut up an apple and have it like on the side or something, and enjoy, and then we'll come back and talk about why I love Linux. Now wasn't that good coffee? I'll bet it was. So here we are, we're back, and I have to say that I've been really, really, for a very long time, I've been very, very passionate about Linux. It's just a really great little environment. I love it. It's been my primary environment for, a long time now. And in the past year, it's actually been almost literally my only environment. I made sure, when I was looking for a job, the end of the year, well, yeah, I guess it was the end of this year, or this past year, I was looking for a job, and I have to be honest, I would not take a job that was going to have me work with anything but Linux. I just wasn't going to do it. I had just come off of a job dealing exclusively with Macintosh computers, Mac OS X, and I was tired of it. I didn't want to do that anymore, and I wanted to work on Linux. So it took almost a year of unemployment to find the job that would finally give me Linux all day and all, well, not all day because it was part-time, but it would only have me working in Linux. But I found it, and I did that, and it was thoroughly enjoyable, and it was well worth it. And I got to use Linux all day, and I learned a lot. I mean, frankly, if you can swing that kind of, what would that be called, stubbornness? If you can do that, if you can afford to do that, I highly recommend it. Granted, not everyone can do that for different reasons, but I was lucky and I was able to do that, so I did. So for a year, really, I was just using Linux all day. I mean, at work, I was using Linux. At home, I was using Linux. Home, such as it was, using Linux, and that was that. So I really had a lot of time to really get to know the environments that I chose to live in, which was Fluxbox and KDE at work and home, respectively. And at this new job, I'm still only going to be working with Linux, but the client computers that I'll be sort of serving will be running OS X. Because they're production machines. Well, when I say production, I mean film production machines. And so they're running, you know, Final Cut and things like that. So that's, you know, there's OS X around me, and I will have to be using it a little bit here and there to make sure that they're working as expected for the people actually using the computers. So I've done this a couple of times so far, gone through and configured things, or looked and to see how my predecessor on this job had them configured, various things like that. So looking into the face of OS X after really almost a year of really not having to deal with it at all. I mean, I know that I used OS X like once during the last year, no, twice. So you know, it wasn't completely barren of OS X, but essentially it was. So seeing it in a very up close and personal way now really got me thinking about why exactly I'm excited about GNU Linux and why it's so good that after you get used to the way it does things, you can't tear yourself away. It's just you can't go back. It's a great thing. You really can't, though. So here's what makes me really happy about the fact that I get to live and work and play in GNU Linux operating environment. First of all, very small thing, these are in no particular order. I should probably play like a little chime between each one so that we know like when I'm on to the next point. So here's the first chime. The robust contextual file menus in Dolphin are fantastic. I should mention, and I'll explain what I meant by that, but I should mention first of all that I'm not going to be comparing this to other operating systems, whether it's OS X or Windows, which of course, you know, I know nothing about, but I'm not going to be doing a look at how great it is on Linux and look how horrible it is on OS X, because that's not what this is about. It really is just the things that I like about GNU Linux. Like the things on my desktop, to be fair, a lot of this is about either KDE or Fluxbox, because that's what I've been using most, but they're usually equivalents, you know, in other desktop environments, so I don't think that they're that specific. Well, some of them are, but you get the idea. Anyway, so this is when I'm using GNU Linux, sometimes I just pause and think, wow, that's so cool. So these are some of the things that I've literally written down over the past about a month of just kind of realizing how lucky I am to be using this environment. So these robust contextual file menus in, or I should say file moves in Dolphin. So, you know, when you move a file from one Dolphin window to another, or drop it into a folder or something like that, it gives you this little pop-up window that says, do you want to move that file, copy it, link to it, or cancel the move altogether? And honestly, that just, for me, that just makes a world of difference. I realize that there are keyboard shortcuts that you can use along with that. You could just do it in the terminal. Lots of different ways to do that. But when I am moving files, and honestly, when I have Dolphin open, I often am moving files. So when I'm doing that, and that little menu pops up, it just makes things so easy for me. I really do like it. So I like that about Linux. I also like the single-click opening on KDE. This confuses people amazingly, and I understand that it is bizarre. I mean, to just click on a file, it opens. It almost sounds crazy to me to think that someone would design an environment where a single click would open a file. How are you ever supposed to drag anything? You know, how are you supposed to do anything without opening a dozen files? But honestly, once you get used to it, and on KDE 3, I used to actually turn that function off. I was like, no, I can't do that. I need double click to open, single click to select. On KDE 4, I honestly don't even know how to turn it off. I just haven't even looked into it because it's just so efficient. It's so difficult for me to go to another system, even like GNOME or Roxfiler, you know, whatever, and have to double click on something to open. It takes a moment for me to kind of adjust to that. Love the single click opening. Configurable file manager. I love this. Again, speaking about Dolphin, to be honest, because that's the one I use. But, I mean, in KDE 4, because of Qt 4 and stuff, it's just so cool because you've got that, like, that side panel and the preview panel and all these panels that you can just kind of grab and move around and put them on different sides of the window or put them outside of the window completely. It's really, really nice. I love that flexibility. And you're thinking, oh, come on, Klaatu, do you really ever use that? Yeah, actually, I use it all the time. That kind of flexibility, you won't be able to turn on one computer that I own and have it exactly the same way as another. That might sound really disorienting and disorganized and confusing, but actually it makes perfect sense to me because I guess I use my computers differently. I guess my workflow is different on each computer depending on what that computer really is meant for in my different activities. Yeah, I use that kind of thing all the time. And the other thing I use, which I guess is basically the same idea, but it encompasses more, is how you can kind of build your own file manager with Dolphin. You can have a menu bar, or you don't have a menu bar. You can get rid of it. You can have buttons, like a button bar. Or not. You can have a filter where it will, you know, if you want just the JPEG, it's kind of like a grep almost. You know, you can just put any random string in there and it will filter it out. Like if you're just looking for all the PNGs, you can just type in PNG and it filters down what you see. So that's quite nice. A search bar, you can have a search bar, which I never use. A side panel, an info panel, the space remaining indicator, the icon slide bar, how big the icon you want to be. You can just assemble this window for yourself, and that'll be your default Dolphin window. And it's great. Again, I use this all the time because, I mean, especially on, like, my netbook, I'm not going to have every possible panel in my file manager. I just want it to be a file manager, and really that's it. So that's what I use it for, and it's very minimal there. Whereas on my old work computer at my old job, I had every... No, that's not true. I had a lot more panels going on, and quite often I'd even have the info panel on because I actually did want the little preview. Different configurations at your whim for whatever you want to do. Something that Peter64 and me are always talking about on Kernel Panics, it seems, are the KIO slaves. So the KIO slaves in KDE's Plasma Desktop, it's a framework to sort of ensure that a command line command that you might issue can also be issued within your GUI environment. It also allows you to do things like accessing protocols so that they just kind of fit into the rest of the system. This means that, for instance, you can go into an FTP server, right click on a, you know, index.html. It'll open as if though it's on your local computer or at least a thumb drive in your local computer. Just open right up in Kate or Kwrite or whatever you use, and you can edit it, and then you can hit save, and it saves it right back up to the server. It's amazing. And this isn't SSH, mind you. This is just like normal FTP. So these things are really, really cool. KIO slaves also will take care of, you can come up with fairly elaborate commands to open up Conqueror such that it's exactly where you want it to be, or it's the proper view that you want it to be. The way that they've built, even I guess the way that K applications are launched, which I think is Kinit, and I can't speak for Kinit really, but I can speak for the effectiveness and flexibility of the way that you can launch things and the different capabilities of the GUI, such that it almost, I don't know, it almost becomes, and I say almost, it was a big almost, but almost becomes as powerful to use the GUI as it is a command line. And I said almost, but you get the idea. The KIO slaves are really nice. Honestly, I don't know of anything that comes close to that in anywhere else. I just, maybe there are things, but it's really nice. I like it. So another bizarre thing that I like is the text editors in Linux. And I know that's like such an obvious bullet point, right? I mean, come on, text editors. The big joke is that Linux has a billion text editors. But you know what? They are actually all really good, or at least the four that I use. So I've got, for instance, Kwrite, which I use just for random, almost like sticky notes. I use them for random notes, for ongoing notes throughout the day, things like that. I've got Kate, which I use for updating an index file and an RSS file and another RSS file. For instance, when I'm updating the New World Order, a lot of times I'm doing that in Kate, because then I can have all three files open in a little side panel, and I can flip back and forth between them, and I can copy and paste stuff from the OGG feed to the Speaks feed, and, you know, stuff like that. It's really, really handy. And frankly, when I first encountered Kate and Kwrite, actually, both times, my jaw dropped, coming from the world that I had come from. Just the fact that a seemingly normal, everyday text editor would automagically know what code I was writing in it. You know, I was doing like HTML and it was highlighting all the HTML for me. It was even suggesting word completion for me. I was astonished. I really couldn't even fathom how such a thing existed. And then of course, Vim and Emacs. I mean, give me a break. And I know that classically those are enemies, but I can't really get into that rivalry. I just like them both. Sorry, I just do. Emacs for XML editing, it's what I learned, and I love it. It's fantastic. Vim for everything else, and again, it's great. It's so efficient, so powerful, so much fun to learn new commands in. It's just so cool. So I love the text editors of Linux, as simple as that may seem. Another thing I love are window shades. And by this I mean that sort of thing that you do on Flux, and you can do on KDE if you configure it this way, is a double click on the title bar of a window, rolls it up into a single bar, like a window shade. And this is something that I love, because I like to get the contents of a window out of my way, but I don't necessarily want to forget or lose track of where that window is. So rolling it up is perfect for me. I use that all the time, and I just absolutely love it, and I know that probably exists on lots of other places, and it's probably very configurable kind of action to get, but Linux makes it really easy to find where that configuration is, and darn it, I like it. Another cool thing about Linux, of course, are the multiple desktops. Love it, love it, love it. And I guess I should go ahead and say, you know, I'm not going to compare everything to another OS, but I will say that OS X multiple desktops still needs a lot of work. Honestly, it does. Just take my word for it. It simply does. They don't have that right still. They're getting better because they've got more configuration that you can go in and define how the multiple desktops are going to work. I don't know if they're getting lots of complaints from Linux users or what, but yeah, their little spaces thing is horrible. Almost unusable, really, because, I mean, yeah, you can use it for simple tasks, but once you start trying to flip back and forth between applications and stuff, spaces just really, really gets in the way. Not to mention that the keyboard shortcuts for spaces are stuck on the toes of some other applications within the operating system, and it doesn't actually warn you about that. So, kind of funny little nuance there. Not to compare what we've got to anyone else, but on that one, it's just kind of, it's almost so blatant that I couldn't help it, so I apologize. But not really. So, unity of design. I think that Linux, bizarrely, I should say KDE, is really, really getting good at this. And I say bizarrely because I keep thinking of that kind of critique as a very real and valid critique, you know, that there's a certain amount of disjointedness in Linux. And I'm going to admit that absolutely there is that. When you download Firefox within KDE, or when you're running Firefox and Conqueror in Fluxbox, yeah, there's a difference. You know, you notice the difference, especially, well, even more than Firefox, I think. Like, if you're in GIMP and you go to save a file or open a file, and suddenly you're looking at this GTK GNOME file picker, very functional, I don't have a problem with it, but it's different. It's not the KDE one, so then you're in some other, you know, you're in Kate or something, and you're saving or opening, and now it's the KDE file opener, and you're thinking, well, why are those two things, why do they feel so different? And then you go to Scribus, which is a Qt app, but not a K app, and it uses the Qt file opener. So you've got a lot of potential for some really wonky visual clashes, but overall, I'm going to say that, I mean, if you lived in like this perfect little KDE-only world, or this perfect little GNOME-only world, which ostensibly at some point we're all going to be able to do, right? I mean, we're not going to have, you know, you're going to have K3B or the equivalent thereof in GNOME, or you're going to have Firefox or the equivalent thereof in KDE. You're not going to have to borrow from other environments if you don't want to. At least that's what I think it's going in that direction. Either that, or they'll figure out some way to truly, truly make every application exactly, you know, either GTK and Qt, no matter what, or none of the above, and just have a basic Tickle or whatever interface. All of that being said, my point really is that if you look at your environment, if you look at a project and look at the environment that they have created before you go in and muck it all up, it looks beautiful. They're really doing a great job, honestly. They've got consistency, they've got unity of design, they've got these commonalities within their own logic, you know, things that they do that once you kind of get a hang of it, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. So these kind of configuration options are in the setting window, and these kinds are in the view menu. Got it. Or, okay, so this keyboard shortcut is going to give me a new tab, and then I can move the tabs around, or whatever. You start getting used to it, and it starts to feel very comfortable, and it looks good, and it feels good, and I like that a lot. I think that's a big deal. Okay, so another thing that I like, and is a really big deal, on a very technological kind of big deal, is the direct correlation between the command line and the GUI interface of GNU Linux. This is a big deal because that's a huge amount of power of GNU Linux comes from that the command line and the GUI talk to each other very directly. They get along quite well with each other. Now, I'm not saying that I'm a religious fanatic over Zorg. I don't know Zorg from any other system, really. I don't know if it's the best. I don't know if it is exactly where it needs to be. I don't know these things. I'm certainly willing to look at other GUIs. You know, I don't have a problem with looking at a Java-based GUI or Wayland or something like that, honestly. My only big requirement would be that it's not separate. It's not a separate system, that the command line and the GUI are still talking to each other in every sense, every possible sense. They should be talking to each other. And that's really, really important to me, because I honestly believe that's the most power that you can have in a computer, is where everything's actually communicating, you know? I mean, that gives you a lot of flexibility. Whereas if you start partitioning things off and saying, well, this is a little bit separate from that, that gets troublesome. And we see that. I mean, we see a move even, like, in the virtualization world, where you've got these kinds of, I forget what they call the someone came up with a buzzword for it, or a brand name for it, where you can run it in, you know, you can run your virtualized environment such that it's Windows just kind of are in your other environment. So it's, you know, you don't have a box where the virtual machine lives. You've got Windows where the virtual machine is running, and you can kind of move them around along with your native Windows. So it's all very, very unified and together seeming. So, I mean, that's the way it's going, is that things are talking to each other and kind of integrated, and I think that's where it should be going, and it's for the command line and the GUI, they should be tied together. They shouldn't ever lose the correlation to one another. Now, again, because I'm not a programmer or an operating systems theorist or anything like that, I don't know if simply saying, okay, well, we need to self-contain the GUI, it needs to be its own little thing, but at least give everything a hook, I would think, such that the command line can hook into it and start talking to it and controlling elements of it. And believe me, this is not the case in other operating systems. Again, it's kind of blatantly obvious in OS X, where, and probably, I'm going to dare say, possibly on some mobile platforms. I would bet. I can't vouch for that, but I would bet. There are things that you do on the command line, installing GNU-PG, for instance. You install it there, and then you go into your GUI, and it turns out none of your GUI applications are actually aware of the fact that you just installed GNU-PG, because you did it on the command line side of your schizophrenic environment, and not the GUI side. That's bad policy. I'm not a programmer, but I know that's bad policy. Let's see, another thing I like about Linux are all the archiving options, and I spoke about this last time, file storage, file archiving, compression, stuff like that. I'm not turning into like a compression guru or a compression fan or anything, but I do like the way that Linux deals with compression and tarring things and gzipping things and bzip2ing things and xz or lisma, all of these things. You've got a lot of options. Well, I just left out like 7-zip and zip and rar. So there you go. You got a lot of options, and they're right there. You can integrate them with your GUI, again, because of that command line GUI conversation. And that's really nice. I like that. If I want to have options to do something, I want to have them all over my system. I want everyone to be aware that, yes, I myself support 7-zip. So that's important. It's really cool that I can do that in Linux. And I love that they have archive preview. I think that's actually a separate point. But I love archive preview. I like that I don't have to decompress an entire archive just to see what files are in it, or to add a file into that that archive. I don't have to decompress it, add the file, and then recompress. It's just a really nice feature. It makes things a lot more smooth and efficient. Keyboard shortcuts, of course. I'm a huge fan of keyboard shortcuts. You know this. I've done a segment on this before. KDE and Flux both allow you to configure all kinds of keyboard shortcuts. And frankly, I can almost not live without them at this point. I wasn't that big on launching applications with keyboard shortcuts at one point, but I really got into it, I was going to say lately, but it's actually been probably a year or more ago. But I just, you know, really, if you look at your daily use of your computer, you can identify generally those four or five applications that you're always opening or just always launching. And for those, I have to say, keyboard shortcuts make it so simple. So I love that. I love the configurability of it, but I guess that's a pretty broad statement. I mean, I love the configurability of Linux in general, and I guess that's kind of the summary of most of my praise. But I think that some of the specifics, you know, should be highlighted, which I already did. So little things for me, little configurability things for me are key. I can't do menu bars or whatever you're calling them, task manager or whatever. I can't do those things at the bottom of the screen. That's just not me. I don't understand that. I have to have it at the top of the screen so I can do that. And you know what's funny about this whole dock convention, and I posted a little screenshot on Unix Porn lately with words to this effect, but I've noticed about myself when I'm around Macintoshes, I find that when I go back to my GNU Linux system, I kind of need a dock. Like, I don't, like, when I go home and use my laptop for whatever I'm doing, I don't need a dock. I have no need for it. I have no compulsion or compelling reason to have a dock. But if I'm around Macs, and then I go and sit down at my Linux computer, my mouse is going to go over to the side, the left side, where I keep the dock on the Mac, and I'm going to, you know, and I expect to see a dock there. So that's one of those cool little configurability things about Linux, right? You can do that. You can turn on a dock. You can turn off a dock. You can put the menu bar at the top of the screen instead of at the bottom. And even little cool widgets in KDE like K Color Chooser. Brilliant, brilliant little device. If you're running KDE, go to your Kicker, wherever you've got it, and add to it K Color Chooser. It'll have a little swatch right there of the color that you of a color. You can click on the little eyedropper next to the swatch and pick, you know, click anything on the screen. That swatch changes to that color, and a little pop-up menu comes up under your mouse cursor and lets you choose how you want to copy that value to your clipboard, whether it's a hex code for HTML or an RGB value for Inkscape or something. You can do that. So it's really, really a cool tool, and one of those little things that you don't really ever think about until you find yourself doing a whole bunch of CSS, and you suddenly realize you keep going back to K Color Chooser, and so it's launched in the background, and you always have to Alt-Tab over to it, blah, blah, blah. Well, put it as a widget in your Kicker. Your trouble is over. It's just really, really cool and just an amazing little thing. You know, it's just so, that's just amazing to me that you can have a whim like that. You can just say, gee, what I'd really like is an eyedropper just right up there in the corner of my screen so I can click on it and use it. And next thing you know, you've got an eyedropper up on the corner of your screen you can click and use. It's just incredible. It's almost unfathomable. I mean, it's magical. It's like, how did I just wish that into being? And there it is. It's right there. It's usable. You're using it now. It's very, very cool. Now, temper that, of course. I mean, I'm being very positive. Temper that with the times that you have no idea how to do something, can't get it done in Linux, you're on a deadline, you're really, really confused and angry. I understand that there are times like that. I will say to a new user that those times diminish as you get more used to the way Linux does things. And frankly, I've not really had those moments in a very, very long time. But yes, it does happen, so don't think that I'm just blindly praising Linux like it never has frustrated anyone ever and never will ever again. It's not what I'm saying, but I am saying that it's highly configurable, and once you kind of start knowing what you can do with it, you start doing some pretty cool things. And last but not least, I should mention the terminal. And I know that the terminal is great, the terminal is fantastic, everyone likes the command line, but I mean the terminal. I mean the real terminal. The terminal that you get when you don't turn X on and you're sitting there staring at text and you realize that because you're using GNU Linux, that's it. Your computer is that. It is a command prompt. prompt, and you can do whatever you want. And you don't even have to launch graphics. You don't even have to have a computer that's capable of doing graphics. And you can do whatever you want. You can browse the web. You can copy, move, rename files. You can automate that in some kind of loop. You can program. You can play music. You can edit sound. You could, not all that easily, but it can be done on the command line, especially if it's something where it's just something that needs to be automated. What else can you do? Well, you can do anything. You can write. You can play movies. You can, with frame buffer support, you can really do that, actually. It's just amazing. It's like, it's a whole computer in what most people see as a really weird text editor that they don't understand because it doesn't seem to save anything that they type, and every time they type a new word, it says that the command's not found. This terminal that we stare at is a robust environment, and it's frankly out of the box, typically, and I say typically because on a live CD that's designed to be just a minimal install, admittedly, okay, it might not be everything you want right away, but certainly with like a Slackware install or a full install of a major distribution, this terminal is it. It's got everything you could want to do in it, and all you have to do is start typing. You can play games, you can go on IRC, you can chat with people via IM, you know, it's just, you can do whatever you want, and it's powerful. And that's really cool to me. That's exciting. It's incredible. It's a computer. And it's not broken at all. It's not held back in any way. Not intentionally held back. Yeah, there are things that it's not doing all that well yet. Things where it could improve, but that can be said of anything. It's very, very cool. Do not underestimate that little command line. It is some wickedly powerful stuff. And those are all the things that just, when I'm sitting down behind my computer, whether I'm at a cafe on the weekend or at my new job during the week or at the cafe in the evening, sometimes I just have to sit back and take a breath, you know, and just like really just realize that people wrote this thing and it's just really, really good, and it's making my life so much easier and empowering me to do so many cool things. So that's why I'm digging the whole GNU Linux thing still. Just thought you might like to know, I guess. So that's probably about all I've got for this show. I should mention that Lorenzosu mentioned to me this really interesting site, obiwannabe.co.uk/html/music/music.html. It's a site, I think, from MIT or something, and it's got this whole book that they're selling on, like, audio programming, whatever that means. But it was kind of in response to the whole Billy Crook idea about quote-unquote vector sound, whatever that would be. I don't really know that the two relate exactly, but it is a good link to have, I think, and it's an interesting site to poke around on. So take a look at that if you want to. Patrick Archibald, turns out he wrote an application. Now, he did a little Ogcast Planet app way back in the day, and so now he's done some kind of, using Google Map API, I guess, and Identica API, he's kind of joined those two together such that you can have a Google Map, I'm assuming it could be an OpenStreetMap or something, I don't really know, but it's this map, and you see these things popping up all over the world, and then you realize, oh, wait a minute, these are dents being done on Identica, and this is showing them as they happen and where they're happening geographically. That is mind-bogglingly cool. That is really, really neat. And, of course, the reason I'm mentioning it is because the music that he chose for this for his little demo of this application was Fat Chance Lester. Yes, he chose the third track on the fantastic alternate universes of Fat Chance Lester, which is called The Plot to Save the World. And it's actually one of my favorite pieces, I think, of Fat Chance Lester, possibly influenced now by the fact that it got airtime in someone else's video, but I don't think so. I've always kind of liked it because it's just John playing the guitar in this really kind of, I don't know, I have always thought of it as kind of folky guitar lick, and I really, really enjoy that part. So I rather enjoy the fine post-production applied to the piece as well. But yeah, so you can hear this piece and see his Patrick Archibald's really, really cool application on YouTube, I presume. So I'll try to find that link and put it in the show notes. So thanks, Patrick Archibald, for using the song, and you know, I invite anyone to use as much Fat Chance Lester music as they want. Yeah, I know it's pretty weird stuff. I like it, which is why I use it in my show. But it's Creative Commons, so use it away. It's out there for people to build upon and create new stuff with. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that this little project of Patrick Archibald's is so cool to me, because a lot of people, I don't think they see programming as art, because they were brought up to think that art is something that hangs in a gallery wall, or art is something that has a price tag on it, or whatever. And I see it so strictly defined by any means. And it seems like this little project of Patrick Archibald's, I mean, I don't know what it's for. I don't know if it was just a practice thing that he was doing, or if it's something that he's posting somewhere on a site for download. I really don't know what it is, but it's really cool, you know, seeing this map and then seeing these things pop up and slowly kind of realizing what you're seeing and hearing this music behind it. It was really quite a work of art to me. So that's very cool. And whether you're going to do something with a program or something artistic or whatever, you know, feel free to use Fat Chance Lester. And obviously all the stuff that the fine contributors of the Great Multimedia Sprint have gathered together for you to use, all those fonts and background textures and stock photos, or no, there weren't any stock photos in this one, but the next one will have some stock photos, you know, all that other good stuff. So yeah, Creative Commons is powerful stuff, so utilize it, truly. Okay, I do believe that's about all I've got for this episode. So thanks for listening, and this has been GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu. You can find me at, on Freenode, irc.freenode.net, as not Klaatu, in the channel of Oddcast Planet and Slacker Media. You can also find me on IM sometimes, not a whole lot. I'm on the Jabber Network or whatever, and my name is not Klaatu there as well. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can visit the site at oddcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Talk to you later.